Hey, G.
Hey, Jim.
I have good news. We made our goal.
Huzzah! We'd like to thank our listeners for spreading the word and helping make our Kickstarter campaign a resounding success. Thank you. And thanks to almost 80 generous supporters, we met our funding goal for Season 3.
80 supporters? Wow. That's like we went viral.
Well, I'm not sure I would say viral, but we certainly did shatter our goal. And for that, I just want to say thank you to my mom. Thank you, Mom!
Thanks, Mom.
My mom made a very generous donation very early in the campaign. I think perhaps in anticipation of us not meeting our goal. But it turns out we so far exceeded our goal that perhaps now she's regretting having made such a generous pledge.
Buyer's remorse.
Anyway, Mom, we're keeping it. And thank you to all of you who made the Kickstarter campaign such a success. We're looking forward to a great third season.
Starting with the interview you were about to hear. Thanks for helping us to continue to share great interviews with great artists.
And thank you for listening, especially you, Mom.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Hello and welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And today we're delighted to have two guests joining us on the program, Richard Sheridan Willis.
Hello.
And Robert Richmond.
Hello.
Richard Willis and Robert Richmond recently collaborated on a groundbreaking production of The Tempest at the Warehouse Theatre. Richard, could you tell us a little bit about how you first became involved in this production?
Yes, I was working with Robert in the summer, and he mentioned this idea of doing The Tempest with the dual characters of Prospero and Caliban, and was running ideas past me because I had played both parts before in the past, and I thought it was a great idea. And then in the fall, he asked me at quite short notice whether I would come in and do it. So that's how it all began.
Robert, how did you come to the creation of combining Caliban and Prospero?
Well, I'd like to say lots of pints of lager, but that would be really too easy, wouldn't it? certainly, you know, Paul wanted a small cast, and I think that was probably the seed of it, that I kept looking at the text thinking, what is the smallest amount of people that one could tell this story with?
When you say Paul, are you referring to Paul Savas, the artistic director of the Warehouse Theatre?
Yes. Yes, indeed. And I think because I kind of shake things up a little bit from time to time, I thought, well, hang on, maybe there's another double here that's never been done and might be interesting. And indeed, not only was Prospero possessed with Caliban, but Miranda was also embodied Ariel. So there's a longer, probably more psychological explanation that I'm sure Rich will give you. But
Robert, was there a precedent that you know of for doing this particular doubling? This doubling that you're referring to, of course, is one in which the same actor played Prospero and Caliban, and the same actress played Miranda and Ariel.
I think, Richard, you mentioned there was a three-person.
Yes, Mark Rylance did it at the Globe with three people, but he was playing Prospero, but he wasn't doubling as Caliban. So I think this is, I can't find any record of it anywhere that it's been done this way before.
And is that with good reason? I ask tongue-in-cheek, well, as a way of inviting you to talk about the particular challenges that you must have encountered with this unique casting scheme.
Okay, so let me talk to that first of all. Yeah, of course, there are certain elements in which Prosper and Caliban speak to each other. So you have to move towards a very imaginative and stylized production. You have to think very clearly about how you're going to tell that and why you're going to tell that and how you're going to justify this idea. I've seen The Tempest, you know, many times before, and I think the overriding question that I've always had is, why does Prospero decide that today's the day, other than the boat happens to be going by, right? But I thought there was a cost, and there should be a cost for his magic. And that's sort of where I started. You know, influences like Pan's Labyrinth, City of Lost Children, these slightly more abstract ways of looking at fairy tales have always sort of interested me. And so I thought that for me, his rationale was that he was dying and he knew it rapidly. He had very little time left in which to put the world right, give his daughter the future that he had always hoped for, and make some amends, one might call it revenge, whatever you would like to call it, and reunite with his brother, or not, as the case may be. So that was the big overarching questions that I had from productions that had never really satisfied me in the past.
So you found a way to inject the whole scenario with a sense of immediacy and urgency.
Yeah, and Richard did a fantastic job of being very sick. So the story becomes really potent and imperative that he tells it. It's 200 lines, something like that, of exposition that is notoriously boring to start any play with.
It's certainly a challenge for the Prospero.
Yeah, it's a tremendous challenge, but also I was helped by the fact that you also know that the audience is tuning in at the same time with any Shakespeare play, so you have some leeway of, you know, allowing them to come into the world without really being there right from the beginning.
Richard, the pictures you sent, are those from the production of The Tempest that we are talking about?
They are. Patrick Cox took the pictures.
Apart from your physicality, which is amazing, the set is delightful. Who was the designer?
Shannon Robert. Yeah, it's an incredible set. It was like a playground. She did such a fantastic job and created this magical world.
Well, Paul and Shannon are doing something magical down there in Greenville, I think.
Yeah, they really are. And we support their mission full-heartedly.
Richard, as a result of playing both characters, did you make any discoveries?
Well, we had a very short rehearsal time, so a lot of it was instinctive. You know, it's inbuilt anyway. When you do these big Shakespeare parts, they never go away. They're always part of you. So, but what happened with this way of doing it was their physicality changed. So whereas Prospero before was stiller and more commanding because he's sick and psychologically troubled, he became the one that was physically more energetic, electrical, and Caliban became the stiller, the stronger presence, which had been totally opposite before. But also psychologically, doing a psychological version with both characters being part of you. So once you were doing the characters, they didn't go away. They were, even when Prospero was speaking, Caliban was there just below the surface. So that was fascinating to find out when Caliban was trying to break through and when Prospero was trying to control him.
In your conception, Richard and Robert, were Caliban and Prospero separate individuals? Were they distinct from one another, or were they rather two aspects of the same entity?
The second. They were two aspects of the same person, very much the Jekyll and Hyde. And so one of the costs for Caliban to have learnt and now have control through his black arts is that he's had to embody the other side, which is this, well, as everybody else calls him, this monster, this person that feels that he has a right to have ownership of the island and is stronger physically and perhaps even in some cases mentally stronger than the person that has somehow imprisoned him. All right, so this is where the Ariel Miranda double comes in, because the Ariel Miranda double is sort of simply this, that, you know, there she is as a 15-year-old girl and all of that, you know, suggests. And Ariel is really the sort of 3 or 4-year-old child that arrived on the island. And so the relationship between Prospero and Miranda is much the same as one would expect as Shakespeare wrote it. Except there is now this idea, you know, this horrible idea that Caliban's side of him has had some sexual interest towards his own daughter. And that's the dark side, you know.
Yes. I mean, that's a deeply disturbing side to get into, especially for one who has 3 daughters of his own. but it is interesting if you think of a man alone on an island for 12 years. To me, the thought, just the thought of it, was dark enough, was monstrous. And it became the monster inside Prospero was fighting this thought.
Absolutely.
That must be an incredibly challenging notion to contend with, but your production concept makes it imperative that it is dealt with.
That's right. And of course, it adds a wonderful layer, or several layers, to whoever is playing Miranda, because now it definitely had a resonance with a younger audience that I think was very, very powerful.
Certainly there is the father-daughter relationship, and many productions bring that to the foreground, but this is taking the father-daughter relationship to a completely different place.
Yeah, it's Cast Away, but with a very dark Pan's Labyrinth kind of feel to it, right?
Right. So how does Caliban feel about Ferdinand?
Yeah, he doesn't really come across Ferdinand. But in our production, Prospero is summoning Ferdinand into the world. So it's a deliberate ploy on Prospero's part. That's the problem is, I mean, there's lots of stuff going on in my head, but what the audience sees are layers.
Right.
Yeah, so let me just take it to a slightly different level in terms of storytelling. But if that wasn't kind of complex enough, I think Richard and I both came to the conclusion as we were sort of working through this idea that there's another layer. We both decided, I think, and agreed, and with Stevie Keese, who played Miranda, that Miranda was actually dead from the beginning.
Huh.
He carried her body fairly Lear-esque into the cave and placed her in a pool of water. And with some conjuring corpse, as it were, came back to life. Rebirth and splashed violently and created the storm. And then she is there alive and present. So you may not have even known that she was dead. It wasn't necessary. But what was necessary, from Richard's point of view, was to know that this was a story of wish fulfillment. This was a story by which Prospero, if he could have anything, it would be to bring that boat, to bring his brother, to regain, you know, Milan. It was to have all of those things that are in Shakespeare's story. At the end of the play, and I have to jump there, you know, he releases Ariel as though he is releasing the 3-year-old spirit, 4-year-old spirit that's inside the girl, and sort of Miranda's soul as well. And her body becomes limp again, and he places her back in the water and he lays down beside her and said the final epilogue to the audience as though he was asking for peace and forgiveness. And so that for me, it was a last man's dying wish.
What I find fascinating about the metaphor of releasing the soul of the young child is that's what fathers do. They look at their daughters as forever young and then they have to let them go. And I think that's beautiful. But I also find that what you have done is you have created dramatic tension in a play that often lacks dramatic tension in production, and quite a beautiful journey for Prospero.
Richard, I'd be so pleased if you would share with us some of the words of Prospero. And we're looking, of course, at the famous speech about our revels now being ended.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were talking about letting your daughter go. And this is right after he has a ceremony, a marriage ceremony. It's a ritual. And he puts on this show. But in the play, he stops it because he remembers Caliban is plotting to kill him and is advancing towards the cave where all the magic is taking place. And so he stops the ceremony. And that's going back to your question about how does Caliban feel about Ferdinand. He's certainly trying to break through at this point. So he's watching the ceremony and he stops it with these words. Be cheerful, sir. Our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and I think, you know, well done, Rich. I think what you heard there is this extremely vulnerable and desperately unhappy father. And I would say the first half of that speech is sort of almost straight down the barrel of Ferdinand. And then that last couple of lines, 2.5 lines to Miranda, and knowing that he really is going to die. I mean, really knowing that this is his last and final hour gives such potency, I think. And to say that to your daughter, knowing that probably it was all for nothing, was a great moment.
Richard, when I listen to that speech, I hear a change come over your voice. it sounds to me that you're coming from a more forward place in your resonance and perhaps speaking in a bit of a higher register than your natural speaking voice or the speaking voice with which we've recently become acquainted. What is the genesis for that?
I suppose it's to do with the emotions, the character, but also the battle that's going on inside him, which I don't have as a normal person, so not that battle. That speech is it's beautiful, and it's very tempting to go lyrical with it. And what I loved about this is that the way it started just before the speech was that I had this explosion, and I was, you know, we had a pool of water on the stage. It was a brilliant set, and I was thrashing about in this pool, and then I would launch into Ferdinand with this speech, which is not the way it's always done.
No.
And it takes away all the danger of going musical on it.
The speech so often is presented as a dropping of a facade. You know, perhaps one of the few times in the canon where we, as an audience, are being directly addressed by the playwright as himself and the character falling away for just a moment. Was there any time where you hear the playwright's voice directly in this speech?
Well, all the time you're hearing the playwright. Right. I mean, you know, it's his last play. And you know that there are many hidden personal messages laced throughout the text. So, yeah, I think it's a man in his 50s who's looking back, who's explaining his craft. And so it became the playwright's words, also became my words as an actor, and also became the character's words as a father. There are many levels it was working on, which you can do on a stage.
Absolutely.
I would hope that 50 makes you a rather young Prospero. I don't like to think of a 50-year-old as primarily being concerned with backward-looking.
You know, to play Prospero and Caliban together, you have to be a young 50s. It's an enormous vocal and physical challenge.
Well, that's an excellent segue. You also played, of course, Caliban. And he's got a fantastic speech, which begins all the infections that the sun sucks up. What is the context of this speech?
Well, this is the first time you see Caliban on his own. In the first scene, he comes out and he doesn't want to do the work. And Prospero says, you have to go out, you have to collect our firewood. And if you don't do it, I'm going to hurt you. I'm going to rack you with these pains and aches. And so the next time you see him, there's a storm brewing. It's coming towards him, and the thunder is rolling. All the infections that the sun sucks up from bogs, fens, flats, on Prosper fall and make him by inch meal a disease. His spirits hear me, and yet I needs must curse. But they'll not pinch, fright me with urchin shows, pitch me in the mire, nor lead me like a firebrand in the dark out of my way, unless he bid 'em. But for every trifle are they set upon me, sometimes like apes that mow and chatter at me and after bite me, then like hedgehogs who lie tumbling in my barefoot way and mount their pricks at my footfall. Sometimes am I all wound with adders who with cloven tongues do hiss me into madness. Lo, now lo, here comes a spirit of his and to torment me for bringing wood in slowly. I'll fall flat. Perchance he will not mind me.
Lovely.
Thank you.
I love the little bit of direction that you get from Shakespeare himself on that last line, that you'll fall flat.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
What's the inspiration for the dialect?
Well, that actually comes from the first time I did it, and I held on to it. Usually, you know, you have time to make Caliban physically different with makeup. And this time, of course, it's psychologically as well as physical. But there's no time to do a different makeup. But you want him to be different in the way he appears to the lords, for them to feel like he is a monster and he's an alien and he's not one of them. And the easiest way to do that is with speech. So I was working the first time with an actor who also happened to be an African prince out of Zaire. So the accent is African. It's from Zaire. So that's where it comes from.
Fascinating. There are many who set the play in the Caribbean and often use a Caribbean accent. And I love the choice of West Africa.
Yeah, I mean, that is the temptation. But I think it's been done now. And hopefully, I think we're going in a different direction. I think that's an old idea, which was useful. But I think now in this age, we're moving into... And that's why I think the psychological side of it is more interesting, because I think that suits the time that we're now in.
In terms of Caliban, one of the things I noticed about him is that he floats between verse and prose.
Yeah, but I always think of Caliban. Caliban's, you know, is his age is 21, and that's what I think of him as this teenager. But I think that the key to him is in the speech where he talks about the music of the island. He dreams it. And he wants to dream it again. So it's about this boy who knows there is something better. That's a world, an artistic world, that in another life maybe aspire to, but he doesn't know how to get there, he doesn't know how to reach it. And so he's trapped in the world that he's in at this moment. There's a yearning in him, but longs as well. But he's got this great anger and this great sense of injustice inside him of the way he's been treated. And it's only the other people who call him monsters because he's different. We don't quite know what the difference is.
It would be interesting to see him as just a regular person.
I certainly believe, he is regular. That's why the voice is useful to show his difference.
There's something in the speech itself, too, that implies that he's not quite... While he aspires to be part of Prospero's world, he's not quite comfortable in this environment either, is he? Because these torments that he describes are all things that are very indigenous to the environment. Snakes and porcupines and darkness and thunder. Things of the earth. And Caliban himself is of that element, but yet not comfortable in it.
No, I think what we did was to make... And maybe Robert can talk about that. But what we did with ours was to make this world more psychological. So those things are psychological torments for him. The island, you know, it's what whatever your hell is.
Your production concept is so bold and original. Robert and Richard, you've both worked together for quite a long time.
Yeah, what do you think, 20 years? Maybe we've known each other, and we've certainly worked a dozen times together, if not. And we are about to both embark on Richard III at the Folger Theatre in DC. But I think that this particular production of The Tempest deserves another go, really, and we would love to find other people that would be interested in producing this and obviously talk to the Warehouse Theatre and see if we could take it somewhere else and continue developing it as a interpretation.
Robert, you've worked with Shakespeare for over two decades now, if not more. What do you think about the popularity of Shakespeare this season, not only on Broadway, but all over the country?
Well, there's been a resurgence, really, hasn't there, of this, you know, a new renaissance in a way, because it feels to me like it is time, from a producer's point of view, it feels like it is a time to do large scale again. And of course, one's not paying a playwright, so that helps. But we are in a situation, I think, where we want to look back in order to look forward. So Shakespeare, as a sort of programming choice, has really taken off. It's a great time to be a Shakespeare director.
Absolutely. Richard, tell us a little bit about your one-man show, Strolling Player, and apparently you have a personal link to Shakespeare.
I don't know about a personal link. I have a one-man show, which Robert directed, and it all came about. I live in Canada, and to become a permanent resident in Canada, you have to name everywhere you've lived, everywhere you've traveled and worked, from the age of 18, which is, for an actor, that's a huge undertaking. So I had to think back through my life to all these places. And as I was doing it, all these stories and memories came back, and I wrote them in a blog. And then gradually over the 2 years, I wondered if they could be performed. And so we workshopped it, and then it turned into this show. And it starts off with my background, which my father was a theater director and ran a theater in the Channel Islands on an island called Guernsey. He had a summer rep theater. My mother was an actress who went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. And my grandmother had a cottage at Stratford-upon-Avon. So they went to Stratford-upon-Avon to have me born there on purpose. And my christening present was a complete works of Shakespeare, and my first walk was outside the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre, where, as I say in the piece, you know, I was held aloft and dedicated to theatre.
You were doomed.
I was doomed, and I grew up going to the RSC with my aunt and uncle, who had seen every production since 1929. So I had this marvelous reference library of when I saw shows. My first Shakespeare play that I saw at the Royal Shakespeare Company was Peter Brook's A Midsummer Night's Dream. You know, I was extremely lucky. So I grew up with it. You know, the book is always with me. It's never left my side, and it's been the one constant in my life. So yes, that's my show, Strolling Player. It's about Shakespeare and about how he's influenced my life as an actor.
Are the blog posts still available online?
They are, yes. If you go to richardwillis.org, there's a link to the blog, and the actual blog entry is called Time Ripples.
Robert and Richard, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a delightful conversation. I wish we had another hour.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Jim Elliott.
And I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And thanks for listening to The State of Shakespeare.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.